Have you noticed how at different stages of life there are things which loom up in the future ahead of you and somehow or other cast their shadow over your whole existence at a given point of time? Now, for many of us tonight, the next few months are going to be like that, as November yet once again rushes towards us. For some of us here tonight, it's the big one, the HSC, just round the corner. For others, there are other events in November that aren't the HSC, but something comparable. And for many, those coming exams, you see, they're coming up, and I suppose you haven't started yet, have you, studying? Just a little way off. You're going to wait for another month at least. But the time will come, as they approach, that even if it's only the night before, the time will come when those coming events will determine how long you sleep, how often you eat, what you talk about, what you think about, what you dream about, and wake up screaming. Now, quite often you find that for elderly people, death is like that. They know very well that death lies ahead, as all of us ought to know. But as it approaches, it can cast its shadow over their whole existence. And you'll often meet elderly folk, you chat to them, and you can't talk to them for too many minutes before they'll share with you who passed away last week. But they're friends, because it's part of life, and it's a real part of life that is more vividly real to them than it is for those of us who are younger. Although, of course, for those of us who are younger, we never know when it will come. What I'm saying is this: there can be important future realities of life that we can become aware of, and as we become aware of them, they can overshadow our whole experience of life in the present. If they're big enough, if they're important enough, then they have that kind of effect. And I'm not saying, not necessarily restricting this to unpleasant or bad events, but big events, as they loom up, as they come closer, they have their impact on us in big ways. Now, I want to take you back to the year roughly round about AD 95. And I want you to come back with me, and if you've been with us over the past weeks, we've been back in that world, on and off, thinking about the realities of life that overshadowed the Christians in that decade, the last decade of the first century, as we find ourselves in the last decade of the 20th. There were not many of them then, back there in the first century, not many Christians, just a few churches scattered around the Mediterranean. Well, actually not around the Mediterranean, but the lands around the Mediterranean. Certainly they were a very small minority in the pagan world in which they lived. And the cities in which they found themselves, each one had its idols and its superstitions and its pagan festivals, along with its own share of filth and corruption. Indeed, as you looked at the Roman Empire, for that's what it was, the Roman Empire towards the end of the first century, you could hardly notice the effect that Christianity had had on that Roman Empire, because, frankly, it had hardly had any effect at all. The empire continued on its corrupt pagan way, and everybody in the Roman Empire in 95 AD worshipped the emperor, except the Christians. They were that small minority group who would not conform to the society around them. They were that small minority group that got the reputation of being antisocial, of being unpatriotic, and worse words were used of them. And as they got that kind of reputation, they were, of course, persecuted. Many of them were imprisoned, in fact, and a large number of them were actually executed because they refused to conform to the society in which they found themselves. Friends, don't ever for a minute think that it would have been easier to be a Christian back there in the first century than it is for us today. Don't ever let it cross your mind. Or if it does cross your mind, you can't stop it, I suppose, but if it does, you might as well exclude the thought immediately, because it's absolute nonsense to think that somehow or other it was easier to believe and easier to obey Christ back then, closer to the events, than it is now. Every doubt that ever crosses your mind crossed their mind. Every thought that if God is real and is active, I can't see him. If that thought has come into your mind, it came into their minds. But for those Christians, small, minority, oppressed, persecuted as they were towards the end of the first century AD, what realities cast their shadow, so to speak, over their existence? What did they find themselves talking about, thinking about, dreaming about? Well, it was in that decade that this book of Revelation was written. And as we've been seeing, it is a remarkable book, because one of the main purposes of this book of Revelation was to give those persecuted, discouraged Christians a glimpse behind the ugly scenes of life, behind the ugly appearance of things, to the ultimate realities, to lift the veil, so that they might see, even if they see it only for a moment, the solid realities which, once seen, will overshadow your existence in the moment. Now, some would say that this book of Revelation is the Bible's most controversial book, and I think there'd be some truth in that. And if that is so, then tonight I think we do come to the most controversial chapter in the Bible's most controversial book. And so you'd be a fool to have a question time at the end of it, wouldn't you? Well, one of the important keys that we've been stressing over the weeks as we've been looking at the book is that we must not forget that what John describes here is a vision. He's seeing a vision, he's seeing pictures. It's abstract art, if you like, it's not photographs. But it's pictures of realities, great and important realities that are as real as any realities. But they're portrayed for us in these pictures, these symbolic pictures. That's going to be very important to keep in mind tonight, and I'll be referring back to it. And tonight we have four pictures, or if you like, four scenes in one big picture, but I've described them on the notice as pictures, so I'll stick with that. And I want you to come with me and have a look at picture number one. Chapter 20 of the book of Revelation and verse 1. John says, I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss, and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil, or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the abyss, and locked and sealed it over him, to keep him from deceiving the nations any more until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be set free for a short time. Well, friends, we come to the most controversial paragraph in the most controversial chapter in the most controversial book in that most controversial of books, the Bible. What do we see here? Picture it in your mind, we see an angel coming down from heaven and seizing Satan, who's portrayed here in the form of a dragon. And binding him up with a chain. Right, got that? And throwing him into the bottomless pit for 1,000 years. Sealing it up. What does the picture mean? Some hard work tonight, so I'm going to ask you to concentrate and work hard with me. What does that picture mean? Well, let's start with the easy bit. It's obviously a picture of the devil, Satan, being put out of action. Right? Not destroyed, that'll come a bit later on, but put out of action. And it's a picture of Satan being put out of a particular kind of action, isn't it? Verse 3, to keep him from deceiving the nations. So here is the picture, picture 1, of Satan, the great deceiver, being put out of action. Well, that's the easy bit. No controversy yet. Here the controversy starts. Is that a picture of something that's going to happen in the future, or is it a picture of something that has already happened in the past? That is this picture saying to us, once we see it, what do we learn from it? Do we learn that one day Satan will be put out of action, sort of like this? Or do we learn that Satan has already been put out of action? It makes a sort of a difference. And that's where this paragraph in this chapter, in this book, in this Bible, starts to become controversial. Because some say that this really is a picture of a future event, telling us that one day Satan will be bound. And many people who understand it this way say that will happen when Christ returns. And they say it must be a picture of the future, because just have a look around you. If you've got eyes to see, you know very well that Satan is very active in our world today. It's got a certain logic to it. But before we accept that very reasonable view, which I think is wrong, I want to remind you of three incidents in the life of Jesus. Don't lose your place in Revelation chapter 20, but please come with me to Mark chapter 3. Read to us earlier on. We're going to go to three passages, two of which were read to us. Mark chapter 3. And do you remember what was happening there in that earlier reading? The Pharisees, teachers of the law, had come up with the brilliant idea that Jesus was using Satan's power to cast out demons. That was one way of explaining him away. And Jesus replied in verse 23, "How can Satan cast out Satan?" Fairly good question, good logic behind it. And then he says in verse 27, if you just cast your eye down, "No one can enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions unless he first ties up the strong man, and then he can rob his house." Now Jesus is using a little picture here of Satan and what Jesus has come to do to Satan. It's interesting that the very word he uses when he says he must first tie up the strong man is the word that was used in Revelation chapter 20 verse 2 about Satan being bound. And what we learn here is that Jesus came into this world in the first place to bind up Satan. Because Satan has got hold of so many people. Indeed, he's got hold of all people. And Jesus has come to bind up Satan so that Jesus can come and rescue people. Jesus can come and rob Satan of his possessions. The first picture. Have a look with me at the next book, Luke, chapter 10. Again, if I can just sketch in, this is the one that wasn't read to us earlier. What was happening here is that Jesus had just sent out 70 gospel preachers. And they had been very effective. And you see in Luke chapter 10, verse 17, that they come back very excited indeed. And they say, "Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name." And Jesus replied in verse 18, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." Jesus said that Satan falling from heaven is something that happens when the gospel is effectively proclaimed. Keep that in mind. And come with me to the third and final of these passages, John, next book, John chapter 12. We'll put these three together in a moment. And verse 31. where Jesus said, John chapter 12, verse 31, "Now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world," by which he means Satan, the devil, "now the prince of this world will be driven out. But I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." You see what Jesus is saying there? Satan being driven out, different language this time, Satan being driven out is associated with Jesus being lifted up, by which he means his death on the cross, and drawing people to himself. Now what do we learn from those three passages? We could add to them. But we learn that Jesus came into this world in the first place. And when he came in the first place, when he died and rose and ascended to heaven, and when his message is effectively proclaimed, Satan falls. Satan is bound. And Satan is cast out. And I take it that that is what is pictured for us in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 to 3, to which we now return. When Jesus came, and when he died for you and for me on the cross, and when he rose again, and when he ascended to heaven, and when he sent his Holy Spirit so that the gospel can now be effectively preached in every nation, Satan was being bound up by a chain and thrown into the bottomless pit to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore. Now, I want to suggest that there is a reality to see. The great evil one, the source of all the evil that there is, the great tempter, the deceiver, Satan himself has been bound, not destroyed yet, but he does not have a free hand, and he cannot deceive the nations any longer. He cannot stop the gospel from going out into all the nations of the world and people coming to Christ. He's bound. He's kept. Now, one thing that I've not said about this picture yet is the most controversial word in the most controversial paragraph, etc. And that, of course, is the 1,000 years, the so-called millennium. Because this picture here, did you remember it, in chapter 20, verses 1 to 3, was a picture of Satan being bound for 1,000 years. What's that got to do with anything? Why 1,000 years? Well, don't forget, because I don't think we'll understand this if we ever forget this, that this picture is full of symbols. See, the chain, it's not as though Satan has been literally bound up with a steel chain. The chain represents the reality of him having been bound, of him having been put out of action. And so it is with the 1,000-year period in this picture, the so-called millennium. I don't think for one minute that it represents a literal 1,000 years, any more than I think that somewhere or other, if you've managed to find it, you'd find a chain, a literal chain wrapped round a thing, and inside the chain was the devil. It's a picture. Indeed, it seems to me that the 1,000-year period in this vision, in this picture, does not represent a period of time at all. It's a way of portraying, as I've put it on your notes, it's a way of portraying Satan put out of action in a thorough and effective, I mean, 1,000 years is a long time, in a thorough and effective way, but not destroyed altogether. Now, in a moment, I'll come back to the idea of Satan being set free at the end of the 1,000-year period, but for the moment, let me say, that seems to me to be what the 1,000 years is about. It's a symbol of the thoroughness and the reality and the seriousness of Satan having been bound. But he's not completely brought to an end yet. For now, I want you just to pause and take in picture one. Take it in and see the reality that is pictured here. The devil, thoroughly put out of action. And you know, if he's been put out of action, then you do not have to fear him. He's been put out of action with regards to his favourite activity, deceiving the nations. No longer does he have a free hand in that, thanks to Jesus. All right, time for picture two, which is in chapter 20, verse 4. I saw thrones, on which were seated those who had been given authority to judge. And I saw the souls of those who'd been beheaded because of their testimony for Jesus and because of the word of God. They had not worshipped the beast, the emperor, or his image. They had not received his mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy are those who have part in the first resurrection. The second death has no power over them, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. Now the second picture is a bit more complicated. We see thrones. Let's try and tease it out and see if we can see the simplicity of what is essentially here. We see thrones. And the souls, I don't know what souls look like, but somehow they're here, we see them. The souls of those who had been executed for being Christians, living and reigning with Christ for 1,000 years. Now what does this picture mean? Well, again, there are some who say that this is a picture of something that will happen one day in the future here on earth. But again, I take it that that is not right. See, if you read through the book of Revelation, you'll see many thrones. In many of the visions, there are thrones, and they're always in heaven. Consistently, they're in heaven. And this, I take it, here is a picture of what is going on now in heaven while Satan is bound here on earth. Who is it we see in this picture? Well, we see Christ, and we see, according to verse 4, the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony for Jesus and because of the word of God. And it's a picture of these people in heaven now with Christ. And what are they doing? Look at verse 4, the end of verse 4. They came to life, those friends of yours, for the people who first read these words, first saw this scene, those friends of yours, who only last week were hauled in by the authorities and put to death because they would not worship the emperor, they are alive. They are alive in heaven. And they are reigning with Christ. They are not the defeated ones. You'd think that the emperor had won, wouldn't you? They wouldn't worship him. They were put to death. That's only if you can't see clearly. But this book of Revelation will lift the veil and allow you to see that they are reigning. They are the victorious ones, reigning in heaven with Christ now. And so when does this happen? Well, I'm saying it happens now. And it's a reality worth seeing. The Lord Jesus Christ is in heaven reigning. You look round on this earth, it mightn't look like that, but you're not supposed to be looking round on this earth to see him reigning. He is reigning from heaven, and his people are with him. And that is reality. Here, why, here Christians suffer. Here Christians die. But that is not the ultimate reality. The ultimate reality is that Christians live, and live and reign with Christ in heaven. Now, in this paragraph, there are a couple of points just to comment on in this second picture, 3 points, in fact. One is that, just to mention in passing, that you notice in verse 4 that it is the souls of those that had been beheaded, not their bodies, that are described there. Now, that's what is happening now. It's not a picture of what happens when Christ returns, when things will be different and they will be raised with new bodies. And so the first resurrection mentioned in verse 6, what that means is what happens to Christians when they die. They live and reign with Christ in heaven. The second thing just to comment on, of course, is the 1,000 years again, the so-called millennium. Again, I take it's the same as the first picture. It is an element in this picture that emphasises that this is a powerful, lasting reality. It's not the eternal reality yet, but it's a powerful, lasting reality. And I notice, I haven't put this on your notes, but in verse 5, that the rest of the dead, that is, non-Christians who've died, they're not involved in any of this. All right, there's picture 2. Picture 3 begins at verse 7. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out. What's he going to do? Surprise, surprise. To deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. In number, they are like the sand of the seashore. And they marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Well, now that's a dramatic picture. The 1,000 years come to an end. And you see what happens? Satan's chain is loosed. The lid on the pit is unlocked. And he gets back into action. What's his action? Well, he gathers a huge army and marches on the camp of God's people. But there is not even a fight, because fire comes down from heaven and the devil and those with him are put out of action finally and forever. What does the picture mean now? Stick with us. First, I want to emphasise again, I won't emphasise this ever again to you, right? Last time I'll emphasise this, but don't forget it. We must be careful in understanding symbolic pictures. If you take a symbolic picture, like really taking a parable in the Bible, and you try and press all sorts of meanings out of it, you're bound to get wrong things. You're never to take a symbolic picture or a parable and build up some understanding of God's truth that you can't establish from other parts in the Bible that state things clearly. Symbolic pictures, you've got to be careful as you understand them and not press all sorts of things out of them. The picture here is a picture of a 1,000-year period that comes to an end. The reality that is pictured is something that is real and thorough, but not yet complete. And so I'd suggest to you that Satan, bound up and imprisoned for 1,000 years and then released for a little while, see, the picture has a time element in it. But the reality at this point at least, other points there are time elements in the reality, but at this point at least, it's a picture of the simple fact that Satan really and truly is bound. And he really is put out of action. But not completely. Now, what action is Satan put out of? Well, he's put out of action, out of the action of deceiving the nations. And so ever since the coming of Jesus, the gospel light has shone into every nation in the world. And he hasn't been able to stop it. And people have come into God's kingdom and he hasn't been able to stop them. Satan has been bound and stopped. He cannot deceive the nations any longer. But he's not completely bound. He's actually still active to a certain extent, like a wild dog on a leash, you know, tied to a tree. You know, he's bound, but within his sphere of being bound, he can still do a lot of damage. So is Satan. He's not completely bound, he's not completely inactive, and to the extent that he's not inactive, what does he do? Oh, he deceives the nations. He's going around working his hardest to deceive people and to keep them from believing the gospel. Sounds like a contradiction, but the reality is clear enough. It's not an actual contradiction. So this third picture is a picture of what Satan is doing to the extent that he's not bound. To that limited extent that he is still active, what does he do? He deceives. He sets out to deceive you, he sets out to deceive me, he sets out to deceive the nations of the world all over the place. He is gathering people to oppose God and to oppose God's people. Gog and Magog. They're words that come from the book of Ezekiel, and they are there in the book of Ezekiel, sort of pictures of the enemies of God's people. And Gog and Magog are being gathered together by Satan, and that is what the evil one is doing. He is gathering forces, vast forces, opposed to God and opposed to God's people. And what's going to happen? Well, look at verse 9 again, end of that verse. This is what's going to happen. John saw it in the picture. Fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever and ever and ever. And I want to suggest to you that there is a reality to be seen and to be shaken by. Satan and all those who follow him will finally and completely and absolutely be overthrown. And when you find that Satan is seeking to get you, and he will, when you find that he is seeking to entice you to follow him, and he'll do it, don't you forget where he's going to end up. I want to take you to picture 4. Chapter 20, verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who was seated on it. Earth and sky fled from his presence. There was no place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before that throne. And the books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what he had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And here, friends, finally, is this picture of ultimate reality, if I can put it like that. You see, behind and beyond all human life stands this reality: judgment. I think it's fair to say that this is the climactic picture of this chapter. This is the most important of the four pictures for us to see tonight. The other pictures might fascinate us and intrigue us as we try and understand the various details, and of course they're showing us very, very important realities. But here is a picture that we all must see. Make sure you see this one. The great white throne that stands alone with the judge of the whole universe seated upon it. And there is nothing to challenge or even question his total supremacy. Earth and sky flee from his presence. And you see, the dead, small and great, makes no difference, stand there before the throne. They really have no choice in the matter. Whether they want to stand there or whether they don't, they will stand there. And whatever else we see in this great picture, see this, that all people in all ages, in all countries, all people everywhere must stand before that throne and the one who sits upon it. The most certain fact of all life is that each one of us must stand before God the judge. There cannot be any escaping it. It is the ultimate reality of life. And starkly here in this picture at the end of Revelation chapter 20, we see the judgment itself. First, books are opened. Again, don't get tied up with whether it's literal or not, but books are opened in this picture. Here is a reality, a record of all the deeds and all the thoughts and all the words that have been spoken. And each person is judged justly. Then another book is opened. It's called the Book of Life. And it's a book that contains the names of Christ's own people. And you know, on that day, when the books are opened that contain everything you have ever done, every thought that has ever crossed your mind, every word you have ever spoken, and you are being judged by the perfect and holy God, the only question that matters is your name written in that other book? The Book of Life. Because if it's not, you saw what happened. Now, friends, we've come to a climactic point in this book of Revelation. Next week, we'll look at chapters 21 and 22 and bring the book to its conclusion. But tonight, we've been brought to see that great reality that lies in the future. And I want to say that if you've seen anything of it, and if you're not sure that your name is written in that Book of Life, and friends, don't leave here tonight without making sure that it is. See, it's a simple folly to move through life ignoring the certain events that lie in the future, pretending that they are not there, pretending that they will not come. Simple stupidity, isn't it? As most of us realise come November, right? You can go through the year pretending that November won't come. You can get October, December. Never happens. And likewise, the great folly of the human race, the great stupidity in which the human race is caught up with, is living in this world and putting it to one side and saying, it will not come, it will not come. It will not happen to me. My friends, it will happen to every one of us. We will stand before that throne. And the books will be opened. You may not have become yet one of Christ's people. You may not be sure whether you are one of Christ's people. Then I hope that tonight you will make sure of that. If you need to talk to someone about that, if you've got a Christian friend who's here, talk to them. If they don't know how to help you, they'll take you to someone who can. If you'd like to come down the front here, there'll be a few people down here who'd be very glad to talk to you about making sure that your name is written in that book, the one that matters.